This is The New Criterion. I'm James Panero, Executive Editor. If you have listened to our recent podcasts with Ben Reilly and Rob Erickson, you will know that this season at the magazine, we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of our Hilton Kramer Fellowship. The HK Fellowship honors the life and career of our founding editor, Hilton Kramer, by giving a recent college graduate the chance to join our editorial staff and apprentice as a culture critic here for 1 year. We have now welcomed 10 fellows as colleagues at the publication, and I am pleased to say several of them have joined our own ranks here as full-time editors. Our editorial staff is now made up of a majority of HK alumni. So this season we are celebrating this achievement with a series of podcasts with our fellows. For our third guest of the series, it is my pleasure to welcome my colleague Isaac Sly, the 2020-21 HK Fellow, our eighth, and now Associate Editor of the New Criterion. Isaac, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, James.
Isaac is a graduate of the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee, where he majored in English. Along the way, he picked up an expertise in Russian literature, rare books, and classical music, all of which factor into his work and life today. 2 years ago, Isaac joined us on the podcast to talk about his travels in Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, where he waited out much of the pandemic in 2020. He wrote about this experience for us, especially visiting the Joseph Stalin Museum, in an article called Local Boy Makes Bad. Well, Isaac, it sounds like you enjoyed your stay so much that you recently returned to Georgia and wrote about it, this time for The Critic, the British magazine, in an article for its March 2023 issue called Land of Ghosts and Legends. This is a story of a lost tribe of crusaders, your own exploration of the necropolis of Anatori, and much else. I wonder if you could read a bit from this wonderful story.
I'd be glad to. Let me give you a paragraph or two from this article. On the eve of Stalin's Great Terror in 1935, the jazz age globetrotter Richard Halliburton made a pit stop in Tbilisi, the capital of what was then the Soviet Republic of Georgia, and a vibrant meeting place of East and West in the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains. Halliburton had escaped from his state-appointed in-tourist guides for long enough to score a massive scoop by interviewing the killer of the Romanov family, Peter Ermakov, in Siberia. The notes from that interview, he claimed, had to be sewn into the coat linings of friends and smuggled across the Soviet border. While in Tbilisi, Halliburton heard a story whispered in the city's basement taverns and tea rooms of an event that had taken place during the First World War. In his travelogue, Seven League Boots, he writes, "In the spring of 1915, some months after Russia's declaration of war against Turkey, a band of 12th century crusaders, covered from head to foot in rusty chain armor and carrying shields and broadswords, came riding on horseback down the main avenue of Tbilisi. People's eyes almost popped out of their heads. Obviously, this was no cinema company going on location. These were crusaders, or their ghosts. The incredible troop clanked up to the governor's palace. 'Where's the war?' they asked. 'We hear there's a war.' They had heard in April 1915 that there was a war. It had been declared in September 1914. The news took 7 months to reach the last of the crusaders. As yet, no historian has found any reason to believe that the legend is not based entirely on fact," he hedged. "Clearly, one should take this tale with a hefty lump of salt. But to Halliburton's credit, he resolved to take a camera and notepad on the days-long trek up to the treacherous, ice-bound road to far Khebsureti, the isolated mountain valley from which these wayward crusaders supposedly marched. Nearly a century later, there is little trace of either commissars or crusaders in Khebsureti. I began my own journey exploring the region in the summer of 2021 in search of another legend in the mountains of Khebsureti, Anatori, a necropolis lying just 3 miles from the border with the Russian state of Chechnya. In a country brimming with myth and legend, where every village has its own ruined castle on the hill and a story of a past king or saint to accompany it, remote Khebsareti seemed to be a final mysterious frontier.
Well, there's nothing like vacationing on the border of Chechnya, is there?
That's right. I like to make my travel interesting.
Isaac, I gather that not only travel, but travel writing is one of your interests. It's a great genre, and one no doubt imperiled today by budget airlines and selfie tourism. Do you have a favorite travel writer? I think of Eric Newby and his Short Walk in the Hindu Kush, a writer that Brooke Allen wrote about for us in January 2007 at the time of his death.
Of course. I'd have to think back to writers like Patty Lee Fermer, Jan Morris, great travel writers. You know, Patty's journey on foot across Europe on the eve of World War II. You know, his writing on Greece and on the Mediterranean. He knew how to write deeply about place and how to turn every journey into a great story, which is something I've tried to internalize, try to do myself when I write about travel.
Do you have any travel plans coming up?
I do, actually. I'm going back to Georgia once more this summer. I'm planning to cover for the magazine the story of a primitivist, naive painter who lived in Georgia on the eve of World War I, somewhere around the time of the story I told here in my article for The Critic. So I'm going to go investigate his life, go look at the village where he was born, see some of the basement taverns and beer halls where he would have painted his artwork on the walls as advertisements and as decorations in exchange for a place to sleep for the night. His name is Niko Perismani. So I'm going on the trail of him this summer.
Wow. I want to turn for a moment to your interest in classical music. Yeah. Before you joined us, you had, I believe, an unusual job working in a recording library. I wonder if you could tell us about that.
Yeah, of course. That was actually one of the things that brought me to the University of the South as an undergraduate. Many decades ago at Sewanee, there was a professor named William Ralston, also an ordained priest in the Episcopal Church. Many of our listeners will know the name Ralston from Ralston College. It's the exact same namesake. Ralston was a remarkable man, taught English at the university, and he changed many lives both in the classroom and outside of it. He used to bring students to his living room after class and fix them a drink and listen to Bach, Mozart, Beethoven with them on a pair of fantastic hi-fi loudspeakers. These were kids at Sewanee, you know, which is a rurally located school in the South in the mountains, Appalachian Mountains. These were kids who'd only heard rock and roll and, you know, 45 RPM records. They'd never sat down and had a deep and meaningful experience with classical music. So what he was going for there was a kind of conversion experience. Many years later, when he passed away in the early 2000s, he left his collection of some 10, 15, 20,000 vinyl records and CDs to the university, together with another great professor whom he worked with, who also had a fantastic collection. In all, this totaled one of the largest and highest quality collections of classical music in the world. So at Sewanee, those former students who remembered Ralston and were grateful for how he had changed their lives and how he had changed the way they listened to music, got together to form a library, a listening library specifically in Sewanee. So that was built around, I think, 2008. It's called the Ralston Listening Library. It's still there, free to use. It's one of the finest audiophile spaces in the world. It's designed bespoke from the bottom up to give you a kind of full body experience listening to sound. Some of the best loudspeakers, some of the best turntables and needles and everything down to the wires has just been meticulously planned. So I was lucky enough to work there as an undergrad volunteering and following that, working as the curator of that collection. So I was, you know, I had an embarrassment of riches on my hands as a 21, 22-year-old. I was in charge of one of the best recorded collections of sound and of classical music in the country and in the world. And I got to bring people into that space every day and teach them about classical music, not only about the pieces themselves, but about the great and rich history of recorded classical music in the 20th century. So we could sit and listen to Beethoven 7, but we could also listen to 5-10 different recordings of Beethoven 7, and we could see what makes each one of those recordings unique and meaningful and worthy to be remembered in music history.
Incredible. And it's probably a good time to plug Music for a While.
Absolutely.
Jay Nordlinger's podcast for us.
That absolutely.
That always deals in amazing recording history.
Very much.
Also, I would say that I wonder if the era of the audiophile is unfortunately past. You know, I remember in the 70s and 80s, high-tech, people really investing in very high-tech, high-quality audio. Now it's all about ubiquity. So it's all about accessibility, streaming, making it easy, free.
Yeah.
But there's a great amount of music that, or sonic experience that gets lost in that translation.
Absolutely.
And in fact, I hear today that recorded music is made for this lower quality sample rate.
Definitely.
And a lot of the nuance of classical music can get lost in the streaming services.
Absolutely. There's a whole, you know, culture of quantity over quality these days. And the culture of listening to music is disappearing or changing, you know, irrevocably. That was one of the things we were trying to unplug people from, especially young people who were coming in, and they'd only heard music on their earbuds. We used to have a phrase we'd use, the narcissism of compressed audio.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a narcissistic quality for music to only exist for you in those earbuds on your commute to and back from work. Obviously, music can fulfill that purpose, but what that neglects is the communal aspect of listening to music. I mean, which was, you know, almost its only purpose for, you know, the broader history.
That's a very good point.
Sound.
From, you know, before the age of the Walkman, which
Absolutely.
Wasn't really that long ago.
Absolutely. Music is meant to be shared with others. It can be listened to alone, but its primary purpose, I think, good music's primary purpose should be a communal one. So that's what, you know, that's why it's important to go to concert halls and hear live music, but that's why it's also important to maintain spaces like the Ralston Library that I was talking about. You know, we were bringing, you know, 5-10 students at a time in there to experience a symphony in the very best quality possible together. And I saw a lot of lives change doing that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people learned about a way to listen to music that has been almost lost.
And I should ask, are you an LP or CD man yourself?
I'm a big LP guy myself.
LP, I have a record player myself.
It's the best way. There's, you know, it encourages you to listen from side to side, from first track to last track. You're not skipping and sampling at will. That's
right.
A different
and
way.
You're participating in it, at least to an extent.
Absolutely.
Flipping the records and putting the needle on it.
Definitely.
Right. Well, now you write about live classical performance. What are some of the concerts you've been covering?
Well, we've been talking about how the culture of listening to music has been changing. I've noticed in New York City, there's, you know, been quite a few new efforts to revitalize classical music, to get people, especially young people, interested in listening to it again. You know, some of these are going to be more successful than others. Some of these are going to involve, you know, gimmicks that are regrettable or otherwise, but you know. So, for example, I went recently to a concert put on by a production company called The Death of Classical. Right, hopefully an ironic title. They hold concerts in crypts and graveyards across the city, usually chamber music and choral concerts. So I've been one to two of those. They've been packed. And again, I think it's good. I mean, you need to encourage these kinds of conversion experiences with classical music. We need to convert people to the cause of classical music. So yeah, it comes through this kind of musical evangelism that I was trying to do at the Ralston Library, or that, you know, production companies like The Death of Classical are trying to do in their Graveyard and Crypt series, right? We need these kind of, I don't want to say shocking, but, you know, moving and surprising sensory experiences with sound and with place as well, environment. That's very key, because you lose so much of the sensory aspect. You lose any sense of environment when you're listening on headphones, on earbuds. So yeah, it's about restoring that, that kind of full experience of sound and of music.
Well, you're so right about environment, and sometimes music does have a place in unusual environments.
Of course.
I recently traveled to Jerusalem and happened to hear a concert of traditional Jewish music in a cistern beneath the ancient city of David in an active archaeological dig.
Amazing.
Very interesting to hear something in that space and to imbue that space with music.
Yeah.
That's a totally different experience than hearing it on earbuds.
Yeah, absolutely.
And hearing it communally in that kind of space.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Well, when you're not editing, traveling, writing, you are also hosting through running our Friends and Young Friends of the New Criterion program and serving as the advance man for our Edmund Burke Award for Service to Culture and Society. Would you like to take us through some of these recent events and what we have coming up?
That's right. We're coming off the tail here of our best attended Edmund Burke Gala to date. This was a great event we had with so many of our readers and supporters. We honored Peter Thiel this year with the award. I was, like you said, the point man on that, organizing all the invitation, seating, just all the various logistics for that event. But it was a pleasure to see so many of you there and get so many kind notes afterwards for how much you enjoyed it. But that's one of just many events that we run every year. This season, up and coming up, we've got a very exciting event on May 11th with Lincoln Jones, who's the director of the American Contemporary Ballet in Los Angeles. He'll be here to talk on many subjects and to give a live dance demonstration with one of his dancers in the office in New York. Also in June, we've got on the horizon our season end party, where we'll raise a glass to another good volume completed of the New Criterion. So I'll hope to see many of you there as well. And then in September, we've got our Circle Lecture, which will feature our upcoming visiting critic, Bill McClay. So that will be in New York in the fall, and hope to see many of you there for that.
And that's too. For our full circle of supporters.
That's right, right. That's right. So your circle members are invited to come hear a lecture and have a drink with us up in New York.
Well, if that isn't an invitation to join our Friends and Young Friends program, I don't know what is. Plus, I should add, by joining our ranks, you get to continue the conversation with our guest today. Isaac, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to the New Criterion. I'm James Panero.
Thanks so much, James. Good to be here.